After that introduction, I'm sure all of you will appreciate the fact that you are looking at an antique. Time has taken its toll, and I suppose if it were not for my persistence, I should have died about 100 years ago. I want to bring to you the love and blessing and greeting from President David O. McKay. Upon learning of my appearance here, he asked me to extend to the administration, the faculty, and the student body his sincere love and blessings and gratitude for the way in which you have upheld the standards of the church. I've enjoyed very much listening to this splendid choir from Orem. Their music is inspiring, and I'm sure we have all enjoyed it, and for you, I thank them. Now, as time is somewhat short, and as my eyes are getting rather short, too, I find it necessary to hold my notes up from the rostrum, the pulpit, in order to see them. Someone has indicated that I have, in the past, expressed the opinion that long hair was not to be a criterion must be met by students. I think that's a bit out of context, but I want all of the students to know that as far as I'm personally concerned, I stand for proper dress and proper personal appearance. I do not believe that sloppiness in dress or appearance are consistent with membership of the student body. I sometimes, when I look at young men whose locks are uncombed and hanging over their shoulders, I'm reminded of my early experience on the farm when we found it necessary to get a curry comb and brush on the tails of our horses. I think you would be interested, and I should like to refer for just a minute some comments that have been made about the Brigham Young University by those who see us from the outside. There's an article called The Mormons from a Catholic bulletin of Williston Park, New York. It says that in the Nixon cabinet, there are two fellows. Tip your hats. David Kennedy and George Romney are Mormons. They're strict. They don't smoke or drink. They give 10% of all they earn to the Mormon church. They've earned a lot of money. Romney gave a year of his life in spreading the Mormon faith in England. Respect the Mormons. Their theology is out of this world. Fantastic and incredible. But they make men who deserve our respect. In spite of the fact that there are only a few million Mormons, maybe it is a good thing that Nixon put these two men in his cabinet. I think that's a nice compliment coming from that source. And this from the Chicago Tribune, May 4th, 1969. As the dust settles at some campuses and others prepare to meet their own unmakers, it is refreshing to take a look at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. The students are clean-cut. The hippie look is almost non-existent. I think we'd like to exclude the word almost. Students stand when the Star Spangled Banner is played, and the ROTC is respected and is growing on that campus. Classes are well taught and well attended. Brigham Young has never had a serious demonstration. Utah's concern for community affairs is reflected logically enough in the desire to provide and obtain a good education, Brigham Young, with a minimum of disruption. Outsiders had better look to their own record before trying to tell us that Utah's out of step. I'd like to read for you, for just a minute, some words by the Honorable John Gardner having to do with current problems. He says the possibility of coherent community action is diminished today by the deep mutual suspicions and antagonisms among various groups in our national life. As these antagonisms become more intense, the pathology is much the same whether the group involved is made up of black power advocates, rioting students, rural right-wingers, urban radicals, or southern segregationists. The ingredients are, first, a deep conviction on the part of the group as to its own limitation and limitless virtues or the overriding sanctity of its cause. Second, there are grave doubts concerning the moral integrity of all others than themselves, a chronologically aggrieved feeling that power has fallen into the hands of the unworthy, that is, into the hands of others. I thought that might be interesting to you to know what others are saying. And James Reston gives us a summary of the situation as it appears today in the United States and other countries. Almost everywhere we look these days, he says, authority is under challenge. The authority of the family, the church, the university, the community, and the state. The main thing is the resort to physical force and threat of force and violence against traditional authority. It's the old question of ends and means. This is what has been going on at Harvard and at Cornell in recent weeks. And this use of force by young campus militants is what really concerns us all. Dean Griswold of Harvard Law School said, "Violent opposition to law, any law, or forcible disregard of another's freedom to disagree falls beyond the pale of legitimate dissent or even civil disobedience, properly understood. It is nothing short of rebellion. The right to disagree and to manifest disagreement, which the Constitution allows, does not entitle the individuals or authorize them to carry on their campaign at the expense of somebody else's liberty or in violation of some laws whose independent validity is unquestionable. Because of the fact that much has been said on this campus and from this rostrum and throughout the United States about sustaining authority, upholding elected officials, believing in our own country, emphasizing the good as against the evil, I say largely because of this fact, President David O. McKay has asked me to read a statement from the first presidency of the church so that you may know that I am not speaking my own thoughts alone. I shall read what the first presidency has written, and it is signed by all five members thereof. in order that there may not be no misunderstanding about the stand of the church in matters having to do with supporting constituted authority, the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints reaffirms our traditional and revealed position, epitomized in our articles of faith. We believe in being subject to kings, presidents, rulers, magistrates, in obeying, honoring, and sustaining the law. We make no statement on how the country can or should be discharged itself from the present regrettable war in Vietnam. That's a problem, a very difficult problem, which must be solved by our government officials, in whom we have complete confidence. I wish you would underline that, because some have thought that our elected officials are not worthy of our confidence, and that they're leaning toward communism, and that behind every bush and tree they're stalking communist agents, including some church officials. We believe our young men should hold themselves in readiness to respond to the call of their government to serve in the armed forces when called upon. And again, we repeat, we believe in honoring, sustaining, and upholding the law. We quote with approval, and this is continuing the statement by the First Presidency, we quote with approval and reemphasize what President Joseph F. Smith, former president of the church, said on the subject of patriotism. I'm quoting President Joseph F. Smith. Patriotism should be sought for and will be found in right living, not in high-sounding phrases or words. True patriotism is part of the solemn obligation that belongs both to the nation and to the individual and to the home. Our nation's reputation should be guarded as sacredly as our family's good name. That reputation should be defended by every citizen, and our children should be taught to defend their country's honor under all circumstances. A truly patriotic spirit in the individual begets a public interest and a sympathy which should be commensurate with our nation's greatness. To be a true citizen of a great country takes nothing from, but adds to, individual greatness. Our national welfare should always be a theme deeply rooted in our minds and exemplified in our individual lives. And the desire for our nation's good should be stronger than political party allegiance. The nation's welfare means the welfare of every one of its citizens. To be a worthy and prosperous nation, it must possess those qualities which belong to individual virtues. The attitude of our country toward other nations should always be honest and above suspicion. And every good citizen should be jealous of our nation's reputation, both at home and abroad. National patriotism is, therefore, something more than mere expression of willingness to fight. This is signed by David O. McKay, Hugh B. Brown, and Eldon Tanner, Joseph Fielding Smith, and Alvin R. Dyer. I'd like to bring to you a thought uttered by Abraham Lincoln with respect to reverence for the law. Let reverence for the laws be breathed by every American mother to the lisping babe that prattles on her lap. Let it be taught in the schools, in seminaries, in colleges. Let it be written in primers, spelling books, and in almanacs. Let it be preached from the pulpit, proclaimed in legislative halls, and enforced in courts of justice. And in short, Let it become the political religion of the nation. And let the old and the young, the rich and the poor, the grave and the gay of all sexes, tongues and colors and conditions sacrifice unceasingly on its altars. I plead with you, my young friends, to remember the words of this great man, which have been echoed and re-echoed since his time and before, and raise your standards with respect to your attitudes toward constituted authority, and do not join any group who has it as their objective to undermine that authority. Now, because much has been said here and elsewhere about the United Nations, and that is a debatable subject, and it has not reached what some had hoped it would, but I'd like you to know what the best men in this nation think about it. Here's what Dwight D. Eisenhower said about the United Nations, and some of the speakers who should support Eisenhower have seemingly forgotten his wise advice. I believe that to support the United Nations organization, this is Eisenhower talking, is the road of greatest promise in peaceful progress. To attempt to hinder or stultify the United Nations or to depreciate its importance is to contribute to world unrest and indeed incite crises that from time to time disturb all men. The United States stands squarely and unequivocally in support of the United Nations and those actions under its mandate in the interest of peace. I bring you now the statements of all the presidents of the United States since the United Nations was organized. First, I want to read a word from President David O. McKay. I think he said, but Secretary Dulles expressed it well when he said there's enough good in the United Nations to justify its existence. Harry S. Truman said, continue your work for the United Nations with all your might and main. Dwight Eisenhower again, the United States stands squarely and unequivocally in support of the United Nations and those acting under its mandate in the interest of peace. John F. Kennedy said, while we shall never rest in the defense of freedom, neither shall we ever abandon the pursuit of peace. In this quest, the United Nations requires our full and continued support. Lyndon B. Johnson said, every president since the founding of the UN has expressed the deep commitment of this nation to the purposes of that organization. And our present president, Richard Nixon, for whom I pray every day, although I'm on the opposite side of the fence from him politically, at least I've been so charged. President Nixon said, we must work to strengthen the United Nations as an instrument for peace. Now, one of the most important things in the world is freedom of the mind. From this, all other freedoms spring. Such freedom is necessarily dangerous, for one cannot think right without running the risk of thinking wrong. But generally, more thinking is the antidote for the evils that spring from wrong thinking. More thinking is required. And we call upon you, students, to exercise your God-given right to think through on every proposition that's submitted to you and be unafraid to express your opinions with proper respect for those to whom you talk and proper acknowledgement of your own shortcomings. You young people live in an age when freedom of the mind is superseded and suppressed over much of the world. We must preserve it in the church and in America and resist all efforts of earnest men to suppress it. For when it is suppressed, we might lose the liberties vouchsafed in the Constitution. Preserve, then, the freedom of your mind in education and in religion. Be unafraid to express your thoughts and to insist upon your right to examine every proposition. Dissatisfaction, what is around us, is not a bad thing if it prompts us to seek betterment. But the best sort of dissatisfaction is dissatisfaction with yourself. In the long run, self-dissatisfaction leads us to improve ourselves. Maturity, and you young people just coming into maturity, maturity implies the ability to walk alone and not be ashamed within ourselves of the things we do and say. Let that kind of independence prompt you young folks as you come onto the scene, which we shortly will abandon. Progress in maturity may be measured by the acceptance of increased self-responsibility and increased sagacity in decision-making. This transition is not a time of calm enjoyment, but of growth and adaptation. One matures as a person by responding differently today from the way he responded yesterday. We observe restraint so that restraints may not have to be imposed upon us. And we do our best to think clearly so that we may avoid chasing after false doctrines. And we use deliberation so as to see through nonsense. We realize our social duty to tolerate the honest opinions of others while maintaining our own principles. Self-discipline. And that's a subject on which I think I have somewhat a right to speak. Because of my military training and experience, self-discipline sometimes means doing things you'd rather not do, but having the courage to do them, if they're right. When a course of action shows itself to be unprofitable, it is sensible and valorous to drop it. There's no personal value in making a show of maturity, which we do not have. Affectation of any sort borders on vulgarity. And at the least, it is ridiculous to pretend to feelings and beliefs that do not appeal to our intelligence. When a human being finds himself at a dead end, he is tempted to turn to that last desperate resource of muddled mankind, lawlessness. He does not realize the unprofitableness of delinquency and of the low standards of living in which it condemns him. He may even imagine himself a martyr in some trivial or irrelevant cause. His hooliganism brings discredit to the peaceful, legitimate, and often courageous protests by young people on great moral issues. You students, having strong desires, you're not content to live merely a miscellany life, however pleasurable it may be. You dream beyond the actual and think beyond your fingertips. In doing so, you're living in the great law of culture, that a man shall become all that he is created capable of becoming. While we speak of independence and the right to think and to agree or disagree, to examine and to question, we must not forget that there are fixed and unchanging laws governing all of God's creation, whether it be in the vastness of the starry heavens, or in the minute revolving universe of the atom, or in the human relationships. All is law. All is cause and effect. And God's laws are universal. God has no favorites. None is immune from either life's temptation or the consequences of his own deeds. God is not capricious. Our relations, the ever-changing impacts of life, will depend upon our goals, our ideals, the vision that you glorify in your mind, the ideal that you enthrone in your heart. This you will build your life by. This you will become. Every life coheres around certain fundamental core ideas, whether we realize it or not. And herein lies the chief value of revealed religion. You young people have been attending a school presided over by the president of the church, a school established by a prophet of God, a school where your eternal welfare is ever foremost in the minds of your professors, your administration, the faculty, and others. Our reactions to the ever-changing impacts of life will depend upon our goals and our ideals. And I'd like to leave that thought with you to ponder. Again, I emphasize, there is no final goal. Life must continue to expand, to unfold, and to grow. If it is to continue to be the good life, these things are indispensable. And in this connection, age makes little difference. There's opportunity for all to expand and to grow and to be and to become. There are forces at work in our society today which degrade an intelligent quest for knowledge. These forces are nothing new. They've always been powerful. They are anti-intellectual. Forces in this country and in other countries are known, grappled with, but they're making headway. The know-nothings of the last century in this country could be cited as one example. Germany in the 30s saw the burning of books and the glorification of the barbaric emotion as part of the tragedy of Hitlerism. We have been blessed with much knowledge by revelation from God, and much of it is lacked in the world at large. But there is an incomprehensibly greater part of truth which we must yet discover. Our revealed truth should not leave us stricken with the knowledge of little reality that is known. It should never lead us to emotional arrogance based upon a false assumption that we somehow have all the answers or all the truth. That we are in fact have a corner on truth. This is not true. Whether you're in the field of economics or political science, history or the behavioral sciences, continue your search for truth. Maintain humility sufficient to be able to revise your hypothesis as new truth comes to you by means of the spirit or of the mind. Salvation and education are both ongoing projects. One may not attain salvation by merely acknowledging allegiance, nor is it available and ready to wear stores or in supermarkets where it may be bought and paid for. That it is an eternal quest is obvious to all of us, that somehow education is involved in salvation and may be had only by evolution of the unfolding and developing into our potential. It is in large measure a problem of pushing back our horizons, seeking for answers, searching for God. In other words, it is not merely a matter of conforming to rituals, climbing sacred stairs, bathing in sacred pools, or making pilgrimages to ancient shrines. The depth and height and quality of life depends upon awareness. And awareness is a process of being saved from ignorance. And a man cannot be saved in ignorance. We today not only enjoy many advantages and comforts unknown to former generations, but we suffer many trials and cope with many problems which did not plague our forefathers. We are puzzled by the frictions and the deficiencies of our society. I think the expression, keep it cool, is peculiar to your age, but it means in reality, do not be impatient. Too many people are so impatient that when they press an electric button, they can't wait for the answer. They think there's a gap somewhere, and they think it's because of the old folks that don't know enough to press the button. History, philosophers, scientists, all agree that life on this earth has been and is one continuous, never-ceasing process of adjustment. Your generation is maturing in mind and body at an earlier age than did preceding generations. And as you become aware of that fact, you're inclined to become critical of the older generations, and often with justification. We're not here to defend ourselves against you. We're here to let you know some things we have learned, and sometimes by sad experience. For almost every young person, adolescence means one thing above all else. He must prove that he's no longer a child. He's fighting to establish himself as a person. I'm going to have to shorten what I had thought of saying, because I want to leave with you at the end a statement from my heart. You're going home shortly, many of you. This, I understand, is the final meeting of this kind to be held on the campus. I want you to take with you to your homes and to your families the spirit of the gospel of Christ. It makes possible for you to participate in the things around you. The organization of stakes and wards on this campus has enabled thousands of young people to become active in the church and thereby to open their eyes and their understanding. This question of participation was impressed upon my own mind years ago when I was acting as coordinator for servicemen. Now, I know the faculty have heard me tell this story before, but they've forgotten it. You young people perhaps haven't heard it, but you'll forget it too. Now, I want to tell you this little story to emphasize the value of participation. While I was acting as servicemen's coordinator, I was in London, England. I sent a telegram to the senior chaplain in a large camp near Liverpool, and I said to him, I'll be in your camp tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Kindly notify the Mormon boys in your camp that we'll hold a meeting. When I arrived the next morning, I met 75 young men, all in uniform. They were delighted to see me, although I knew none of them. They were glad to see someone from home, old and decrepit though he may be. There stepped out from the crowd a man who, after shaking hands, said, I'm the one to whom you sent your telegram. I'm the chaplain of this camp. I didn't get your telegram until this morning, that Sunday morning. He said, upon receipt of it, I made an inquiry, a careful inquiry. I found there were 76 Mormon boys in this camp. 75 of them are here. One is in the hospital. He says, I wish you'd tell me, Mr. Brown, how you do it. I have 600 men in my church in this camp, and if I gave them 6 months' notice, they couldn't meet that record. Tell me how you do it. Well, I said, if you'll come into our meeting, we'll show you how you do it, how we do it. And so he accompanied me into the Quonset hut, and before us sat these 75 young men. I had the minister sit next to me. I said, how many of you fellows have been on missions? Fully 50% of them raised their hands. I pointed to 6 of them and said, come here and administer the sacrament. I pointed to 6 others and said, come here and be prepared to speak. I looked at my friend, the minister, and he had his mouth open. Never seen such thing. And then I said, fellows, what shall we sing this morning? And with one voice they said, come, come, ye saints. I said, who can lead the music? And most of them raised their hands. I selected one. Who can play this portable organ? And again, there was a fine showing, and one was selected. Now, we didn't have any books, but the man at the organ sounded a chord. And those young men stood, shoulders back and chins pulled in. And they sang all verses of Come, Come, Ye Saints. Now, I've heard that sung all over the church many times, even by the Tabernacle Choir, to whom I apologize for what I'm going to say. I have never heard Come, Come, Ye Saints sung with such fervor, such conviction, such power as those young men sang it. When they came to that last verse, and said, and should we die before our journey's through, happy day, all is well. I tell you, it was thrilling. And as I looked at my friend again, I found him weeping. After the prayer, one of the boys knelt at the sacrament table. And he said, O God, the Eternal Father. And then he paused for what seemed to be a full minute before proceeding. At the close of the meeting, I went and looked him up. I put my arm across his shoulder and said, what's the matter, lad? He said, why? Well, you seem to have difficulty in asking a blessing on the bread. Has something happened? Well, sir, he said, a few hours ago, I was over Germany and France on a bombing mission. We had made our run, left our calling cards, meaning the bombs, and when we gained altitude and were about to return across the channel, we ran into heavy flak. My tail assembly was pretty well shot away. One of my engines was out. A number of my crew were wounded. And it looked like a hopeless situation. It seemed like no power in heaven or earth could get us back across the channel to a landing field. But he said, Brother Brown, up there I remembered that my mother had said to me, and this I want to say to this vast audience, both those that are here and those that are listening in, this is what my mother said, if ever you come into a situation where man can't help you, call on God. I had been told that same thing in primary, in the religion classes of the early days, in the seminaries, in Sunday school. If ever you need help and man can't help you, call on God. And although it seemed hopeless and impossible, I said, O God, the Eternal Father, please sustain this ship until we get back into England. Brother Brown, he did just that. Now, when I knelt at the table, when I heard of this meeting, I ran all the way to get here. And when I knelt at the table and named his name again, I remembered shamefully that I had not stopped to say thank you. And that's the reason I paused, to express my gratitude for the goodness of God. Well, we went on with our meeting. These young men spoke, and they spoke with power and conviction. Everyone who heard them was thrilled by the evidence of their faith And my friend continued to weep. When they'd finished talking, I said, "Fellows, we'll have to dismiss." That meeting was not like this. It had to be dismissed on time. I said, "We'll have to dismiss or you won't get any grub." They said, "We can have army grub anytime. Let's have a testimony meeting." Well, I said, "If you have a testimony meeting, you'll be here another 2 hours." They repeated with one voice, "Please let us have a testimony meeting." I turned to my friend, the minister, and said, "Now, I know this is unusual for you. We've been here 2 hours, and we're going to be here another 2 hours. We'll excuse you if you prefer to withdraw." He put his hand on my knee and said, "Please, sir, may I remain?" And of course, I encouraged him to stay. And then, for 2 solid hours, those young men, one after another, stood up and bore witness of the truth of the gospel. My only job was to say, "You're next, and then you, and then you," because all of them wanted to get up at once. It was a glorious occasion. Finally, there came an end. We dismissed. And this minister turned to me and said, "Mr. Brown, I have been a minister of the gospel for 21 years, but this has been the greatest spiritual experience of my life." And again he said, "How do you do it? How did you know which of those fellows to call on?" And I said, wouldn't make any difference which one I called on. They're all prepared. And this could happen in any camp anywhere in the world where the 75 young Mormon boys. I relate this to you, my dear students, that you may realize the value of participation, the value of a conviction of the truth, and that you may take advantage of every opportunity to bear witness to that truth. And I bear my witness to you now as you leave for home. And as time goes on, I do not know that I'll be here again. And that doesn't matter much as far as you're concerned. But I want to leave this witness with you. And I'm too old to try to deceive you. I have one foot in the grave and waiting to kick the bucket with the other. But this I want to say to you before I leave. And I say it with apologies for holding you a moment. With all the fervor of my soul, I know that God lives, that He is a reality, that He's a personality, that Jesus of Nazareth is and was and will ever be the Son of God, the Redeemer and the Savior of the world. I know that better than I know anything else. And I say with Peter of old, who was asked, "Whom say ye that I am?" He replied, "As I reply." He replied to the same authority with which I speak, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." And he was told by the Master what I've been told by him as well. "Flesh and blood did not reveal this unto you, but my Father which is in heaven." God bless you, my dear friends. Please accept my apologies for my volubility. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.